Welcome back, everybody, to episode 2. This is a 3-part series of a conversation I have with my friend Patrick, who is an air traffic controller in Salt Lake City. He works for Salt Lake Tracon. He's been doing this for 18 plus years, a true professional, textbook definition of what a professional is. He's also very passionate about his work, which makes him that kind of actually the definition of being a professional. He is also an avid photographer and a strong supporter of the aviation community. He's befriended a lot of pilots and aviation enthusiasts, and on his page, you can find his work at in Instagram. On his name there is Radar Contact, R-A-D-R Contact. And last but not least, I'd like to give a huge shout out to my friend Mike, who was my sim partner in upgrade training. Thank you so much for putting up with me and your patience and helping me out passing this training. We just both passed our check rides recently for upgrade, and Mike is now out flying his first IOE trip, or initial operating experience. So we're getting basically signed off by a line check airman that we're okay to go fly with by ourselves, right? We're going to take the training wheels off. So thank you so much for your support. Mike, I want to have you on the show because I want to share your story with my friends, because you're a fascinating guy. You have a lot of cool stories, and I'm sure you have many more that you didn't tell me. And I want to, you know, kind of share that friendship with my friends or something like that, you know. But anyways, but just a little sneak peek. Mike is actually a co-creator of a comic strip called Chicken Wings Comics, and you can go and visit their website. It's chickenwingscomics.com. Him and his brother Stefan have been doing this for over 2 decades. So this is a worldwide renowned comic that I've seen it before, I think, in passing, but I was never a comics guy. But it's impressive what they've been doing, you know, what they've done with their comic over the years. And it's funny, and they have really lovable characters, and that you can probably identify with some of them. But it's aviation related. It's an aviation related comic, and it's really cool. I really like it, and I want to bring awareness to my friends so you guys can check it out. Once again, chickenwingcomics.com. You can go ahead and check them out there. Anyways, I'm done talking. Let's go ahead and get started with this second episode of a 3-part series with my friend Patrick. Let's go. Hey folks from the flight deck, this is your captain speaking. Welcome to the Tailwinds and Sunshine podcast, where we talk everything aviation. I am your host, Manny Ramirez. It's always a pleasure to have you on board. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Yeah. So when this hiring happens, or this selection process happens, you went to UND.
Yep.
So how does that work to get hired on to work as an FAA controller, and where does it start? Because I know that you wanted to work, you know, you looked at the tower as a kid. It's like, I want to work at the tower, but you've never worked a day in your life in the tower. So how does it work to get selected? Is it like a selection process to get to work as a controller?
It's a little bit, but it's not like the interviews. Like I've been through airline interviews, like through like doing like ramp agents and stuff.
Yeah.
I had gone through ramp agent like interviews with SkyWest and saw kind of like what I would imagine would be kind of like what the pilots interviews would be like. I mean, obviously a little bit different, but I feel like that gave me a good understanding as to kind of how that would work. But for us, we had to take a test, like kind of a government test. It was called the ATSAT, and they had just changed the test. There was one that you could study for just before you're done, but you had to pass this test in order to be eligible to for hire when the hiring opened. So it was a lot of pressure. And because of the change, I couldn't take the test until it was my last semester. So here I am going through all of my schooling. It's like my last semester. And then it's like, it's down to this test. So, I mean, I never went into it being like, oh, like I'm never going to make it, but it's just the weight of it, right? It's like,
yeah,
here's the granddaddy test of them all.
Right.
I didn't want to fail, but I also wanted to score high. I wanted to place high, because that would also determine how they would mark you at the time. I could be wrong. It was either like you were qualified or like well-qualified type thing.
Okay.
I think is how they kind of deemed it. I can't remember what the cutoffs were, but I remember going into the test and just being like, all right, like this is the longest test ever. It was an 8-hour test.
Oh my God.
And then they're like, okay, like you're at the 4-hour mark. We're going to stop. Everybody goes and takes a lunch. And I was like, I don't want to take lunch. I want like,
I just
want
to be my done brain with is
in it.
Yeah.
I want to keep going, but they're like, nope. Like you have to go take like,
gotta take go. A lunch.
So I remember like just head is like overwhelmed and I don't even know why I remember it, but I remember I went to Arby's. I don't even eat Arby's, but it's like I went to Arby's.
Whatever was available, you're like, just like food.
Yeah. I'm like I'm trying to just distract my mind, keep it like it's like going to a football game and it's like you're down, right? And then it's like I don't want to go to halftime because I have the momentum. I want to keep going.
Exactly.
So that type of thing. So it's like, all right, I have to keep my mind like in tune, like on point so that even this break doesn't slow me down. Finish the last 4 hours, and then you don't find out for about a week.
Oh man!
It doesn't go to. It didn't come to me in North Dakota where my results were. They mailed them to. I didn't have a permanent address in North Dakota, so it got sent to
Alaska.
My parents' house.
Back it got sent to Alaska. No.
Yeah, it got sent to Alaska. It got sent back to Utah. So
yeah,
I waited, and then. My parents called and opened up the letter and then it was just like, all right, like just waiting, like, come on, come on.
Yeah.
And then finally came across well qualified, good to go. I passed. And it was like, at that point, all the classes were coming to an end. Everything was fun. And then after you take the test and you pass, they send you out a questionnaire. Now this doesn't happen anymore. So this is back in 2006. They sent us a letter that said, okay, choose your top 5 states that you want to be eligible for higher when it does happen.
Okay.
So I was one of the first groups out. There was a few of my friends that were a semester or two behind and they got word that the first state that was going to start hiring for controllers was Texas.
Okay.
And I was like, I don't want to move to Texas. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
So I had Hawaii, I had Utah, Alaska, and California and Nevada, I think is what I had. So I knew I wanted to work in Hawaii at one point in my career. I was like, I'll get somewhere, I'll work my way up, I'll try to get home, and then, you know, like when I get married, like have kids, like we'll go over to Hawaii. Like, so I waited. Next thing I know, it was, I graduated May. I got a call in October or November.
Okay.
And they said I was hired for Las Vegas for McCarran Tower.
Nice.
And I was like, this is awesome. Down the road, I spent the majority of my birthdays in Las Vegas, like all growing up, because we just love going down to Vegas as a family. And so it was kind of like a second home. So I was just like super stoked on it. And then right around the start of December, I got a call and they just said, have you planned anything? And I said, like, not yet. I'm getting ready to go down this weekend to start looking for a place. And they said, like, well, don't. Just don't. So I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, you've been pulled from the hiring. And so I was like,
and there's your heart sank at that. I was like, what the hell happened?
Yeah. I'm like, so am I like not eligible for hire completely or like what's going on? They said, no, like we just hired internally into Vegas. So basically they filled the vacancy that
from within.
Yeah. Just another controller that wanted to transfer there. Mm. So I started calling about once, sometimes twice, we won't admit more than that, a week trying to follow up onto what my status was. Because this is, by this time, all my friends, even the ones that were a semester behind, had already been picked up in Texas.
Yeah.
And some people had gotten some other places. So I was like, what's going on? And then I remember picking up the phone one day, I was at work and made my normal call, got to the same person that I normally talk to and just said, you got anything for me? And she just said, actually, I do. She's like, you're going to a Honolulu control facility. And I just stopped and I was like, the control facility? Like, why aren't we talking about airports?
Yeah.
So I thought I was going to flight service, which didn't seem to make sense because it was like,
yeah,
that's not what the scope is. But then I was just like, wait, what's the Honolulu control facility? She's like, this is like the big daddy of the Hawaiian Islands. Like, you've basically worked the entire island chain. Like, you're based at Honolulu International, and then it depends on what side you get put on as to what you do for, like what role you take on as a controller.
Mm.
So she said that, and then I reported to Oklahoma in June of 2007 to start up from there. So I was Honolulu from December. I knew that. And then it's kind of where everything for me started, but that was kind of the hiring point and kind of how you get selected. You you sit down with an interview, kind of for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down with the current, well, when I transferred back to Salt Lake, it was my manager, but I had known her for a long time because I used to tour the Traycom as a kid with that neighbor that worked there. So yeah. I kind of got to know people and know her. So when she saw me come in for the interview, she's like, oh my gosh, like we're picking you up. And then she looked at the paperwork and saw that I was selected for Honolulu.
Yeah.
She's like, well, if I change this, like if I can make it work, would you stay here? And all I remember was like Gary's last words to me in North Dakota was like, you never, ever say no. So I was just like, yeah, like I'm grateful for wherever will have me. Like, just want to be there, like happy to be here type thing.
Yeah.
And so it never happened. And I'm actually very grateful because I'm the best almost 5 years of my career were Honolulu.
Wow.
It was just such an awesome experience, such an awesome facility full with awesome people.
That's really cool. That and so the one thing that I noticed is that you went to school, so you did all your training.
Yep.
And then you had to go to Oklahoma City. Is this where all controllers go to first to get training, to get like spun up on whatever they're going to be doing?
Yep. Oklahoma is kind of like your in-doc location.
Oh, okay.
So you get in there, you get sworn in as a federal employee, and then you start training. Now, the thing that's awesome about North Dakota and Anchorage is that their simulators are based on everything that's at Oklahoma. So
okay.
The airport, the runways, the airspace, everything is the exact same. So it's like you walk in and it's like you're instantly like, I'm so comfortable because I'm in 100% familiar territory.
Yeah.
So you go in, you learn. The only thing that was different was we didn't do tabletop stuff for. Do you know what tabletops are? Have you heard of that?
I don't know. No.
So tabletop is like kind of a way they train tower controllers where it's literally like you have this airfield that's on a table out in front of you and you're kind of on this like stand in the room. And behind glass, so it's mimic like you're in a tower.
Right.
And then you have people that are supposed to, that they're sort of like literally holding a model plane that are like, this is a 737 and this is a Skyhawk. So you're supposed to walk the according to like the plane you're holding. So it's like you're manually holding this plane and moving it. And then the controller that's training is basically controlling it based off that. It's really weird, but it's a lot of just not very accurate training because it's like when you see somebody
it sounds like something like out of the 50s. Like it sounds like, you know, that just like when they used to actually move little airplanes on the board, you know, like pins. It sounds really archaic. It's like wow. Yeah.
I remember when I walked in the room, I was like, no, I will, I don't know. I would hope
you don't know.
Just because I'm like, when you see somebody walking around with like a little Skyhawk and they're going faster than the 737 on fine, I'm like, we got a problem. So
Yeah, that's not, they got jet engines on that thing. And so when do you know, is a facility you got hired on, or they're the ones that are going to say, hey, you're going to be going to tower, hey, you're going to be going to radar, you're going to be going, or terminal, or Traycon, are they the ones that decide your position?
So yeah, so not every facility, so this is kind of where, like I look at where I work is very much like another like side of my family, right? Because it's like you work with these people day in and day out. I see the same faces. I see the same people. I'm assigned to pretty much the same crew. When you start working your seniority, that seniority usually sticks together and they stay together. But when I got to Oklahoma, my operations manager from Honolulu, there was one other person that was there that was coming to Honolulu with me, and she was from Hawaii. And her dad worked in the facility as well. And so he came in to visit us because that's not a requirement. I don't know. Again, it's that first impression thing that stood out to me. It was like my operations manager flew all the way from Honolulu all the way out to Oklahoma to come meet with us and take us. He took us out to lunch to get to know us. And it was a different time just because they had just cut all of our pay rates down. So it was like, and we had to pay kind of our own way in Oklahoma, whereas now they get per diem, but we were making like $8.42 an hour while we were in training. I was making more money at my other job waiting for this one.
Yeah.
But he took us out to lunch and just like, it wasn't anything about like who he was. It was just more internally, like, this is my boss. This is like my manager. Like I was self-intimidated because I was like, this is it. Like I'm in, like, this is like the guy that's going to be like my boss. I'll see him all the time. Like he calls the shots. Could not have been a nicer guy. I still look up to him and he's kind of like the epitome of like who I think and how an operations manager should always be. His name's Robert. I'll go that far, but he landed up being somebody that wasn't just my manager, became a very good friend of mine and somebody that I knew genuinely cared about me. But he took us out and then just instantly turned to us and said, well, he's like, your seniority plays for you already. He's like, you get to choose. He's like, your top seniority in the training department. So you get the choice of either going to the Honolulu Tower Tracon. So you would work the Honolulu Tower and the Tracon for Honolulu itself, or you would go to Island Approach. Island Approach consisted of CRAP, which is center, and you're dealing with non-radar oceanic and all the oceanic procedures. But you're also running the center approach control into the outer islands. And we also worked Maui Tracon. So I actually certified. So I chose tower because I was like, well, I'm here, right? I'm training tower. So I told my manager, I was like, no, like I want to do tower. Like that's just been like, what more of a dream could you want? Work Honolulu, look out, see Waikiki, be right there, look at the reef runway, see everything. I'm like, tower. So he's like, right, you got it. So he went back. I finished the training. We were there for about a month and a half total in Oklahoma. And then I got to the facility day one. And everybody, there was a manager's meeting going on. So there was actually a manager from Utah, from Ogden Tower, that was here. It was at that meeting. And she's like, hey, he's like, you're the ones from Utah. You're the one that's from Utah. I was like, what? Do you know what like area you're going to here? And I was like, oh, yeah. I'm like, I'm going to the tower. And that's when I saw Robert pop out of the room. And he's like, no, he's not.
Oh.
And so I looked at him. And he's just like, nope. He's like, you're going to Island Approach.
Okay.
And so I was like, okay. I'm like, radar it is. I'm like, we'll go with that. So I just got books and maps and they just had me in a training room and they said, until we can figure out how we're going to run the training, go teach yourself center radar and procedures and everything. So that's where it kind of started for me. So it was originally.
You literally got thrown off the deep end, huh? And trying to say, well, we got to figure this out, but teach yourself. There you go. We're not going to pay. Teach yourself. You got sent to basically HCF, right? Is that what I call it?
Yep.
And you got there and you got to teach yourself pretty much everything you needed to know to start controlling. Yep. And now initially you wanted to go to tower, but they had different plans and you went to HCF. And was it, it's kind of hard because when you go, the way that I see it, and I think many people see it, is when you become an air traffic controller, you figure you go to school and you kind of get all that out of the way. When you went to UND, for example, did they teach you everything? So how to control like center, tracon, radar, towers, yep. Did they teach you everything there?
Yeah, so they taught us a lot of tower and basically terminal radar, so tracon.
Mm.
But then right towards, it was my last semester, that's where they kind of got the inclination that the centers were most likely going to be the initial like hiring. That's where most of the new hires would go.
Okay.
So they quickly revamped some of the classes to incorporate en route into it as well.
Okay.
To basically teach us what we needed to know. Obviously, it wasn't going to be like everything, but it was enough to give you like a good solid foundation to understand en route and kind of what they were doing. But we were definitely more equipped for the terminal side.
Okay.
So that was kind of the challenge for me. But
so when you said 5 years in Hawaii? Is that what you said? You spent under 5 years in Hawaii. And then you ended up transferring. How did that work? The transfer to back to Salt or going to Salt Lake? How did that work? Did you put in for a transfer or did you get a position offered?
No. So generally it was kind of one of those weird things. It was like, do I really want to leave Hawaii? You know, when I got there, it was like the way I explained it to people is that all of my family was back here in Utah. This is where I'm born and raised. So it was different being in Hawaii, like when you're like by yourself. And I got to meet a ton of people, made a ton of friends. And that's where it was like, I got so involved with like the aviation community because it was like, it wasn't just the people that I dealt, like I worked with and spent time with every day in the facilities, but it was the pilots that I was meeting when I was flying around the islands. And all of a sudden I became friends with them. I was hanging out with them and got to like ask questions. And then all of a sudden it was like people knew, and this is like, it's a unique airspace because you get a lot of the people that come in, you know, flying the heavies, and there was a lot of heavies back then. Not as much as anymore, but it was heavies everywhere. But for the inner island stuff, it was the same pilots day in, day out. So it's like you really got to know the controller by their voice. You got to know pilots by their voice. But I got to know the pilots because I got to hang out with them.
Nice.
And get to meet them and get to know them and get to answer questions and let them, you know, I could ask them questions. So it was really an awesome, awesome like time out there. And those friends that I have are still friends I have now. Like that's a, it was a life like friendship that was created out there.
Yeah.
But the hard part was, is that like, you know, anytime that I would have time off, I wasn't going anywhere. I was literally just going back to Utah because it was like, you know, like I missed my family. I wanted to see like my siblings and like my parents and my friends and stuff. But I think I was like, I don't really know like what I want to do, like what I want to accomplish. And then I remember sitting down and talking with like my manager and stuff and through training, and he just was like, you're not going anywhere. Like we don't want to lose you type thing. And
yeah,
he went so above and beyond, like I'm not even gonna get into it, but it's like, he was legit probably one of the coolest people I've met in my career. But looked out for me, took care of me. It was like being there by myself. I got kind of like adopted into as like all these like different like moms and dads and brothers and stuff like all over the yeah. place. Like when you hear people talk about Ohana in Hawaii, like it takes on this whole different meaning when you actually are a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, that's why it was so bittersweet when I finally transferred out. But kind of the process was, is that my brother had his first child, and it was the first niece or nephew I'd ever had. And I flew home, and they wanted, even my manager was like, hey, like I heard like you have a niece, like, are you going to go see her? And I was like, well, I don't have the time off. I'm new in the career. I don't have that much time. And he's like, we'll make it work. So he helped me figure this thing out, let me come home. And then when that first time was that I saw my niece, I just was like, it's time. Like I need to try to like start working my way back. And that's when I went into, like I came home that same trip when I came to see my niece, I actually went in to see the manager here at the Tracon.
Yeah.
And just said, hey, what do I got to do? It's time to come home. You know, it's like, I don't expect it to happen, you know, tomorrow, but like, what's the process? What do I need to like start doing? So
yeah,
we walked through the options. And then even when I got back, it was like my managers knew that I had made a visit to the facility here. And they're like, I told you not to visit. Like, but joking, of course. But they were like,
yeah.
When I left, it was like, it was evident. They knew it was a matter of time before I would most likely go back to Utah. But they were trying everything to keep me. And I honestly didn't have any intent to leave until that one trip home.
Yeah.
And so that kind of changed the course. But it was 100% an employee request for transfer. So it was just, it's another way. So if there's not an opening for a facility, so they were staffed, but with no bid. So if like our staffing goes below numbers, or there's projected to go below numbers, a bid will go out to basically say, hey, like we need control to Salt Lake. Anybody interested in coming here or moving out of the lower level facilities wanting to come up, you basically apply to it like a job, but it's an internal progression, right?
Just like what they were doing in Vegas, you know, when you went there. Yeah.
Yep. Cool. Exactly.
Cool.
So they landed up, there was no openings. There was no bid for Salt Lake. So the manager here in Salt Lake just said, just put in a request for transfer. We call an ERR, for it's just an employee request for relocation, which basically just shows that like, hey, you know, like there's no bid out, but I see this person wants to come out and they're qualified and I actually could use this person. Then the managers had say where it's like they could actually pick you up off an ERR list instead of a bid. So that was like, okay, she just like put it for the tower and put it in for the Tracon. So I was like, all right. And then she's like, well, she's like, let me ask you, like, what do you prefer? So I was like,
yeah,
well, I've missed Vegas Tower, I've missed Honolulu Tower.
Yeah.
And now I'm 5 years deep into CRAP and Tracon. I was like, I'm comfortable with radar. And my thing was, I just want radar. She's like, perfect, because I need Tracon.
Yeah.
And everybody that wants to come here wants tower. And I was like, well, then I'm your guy, because
I'm your guy.
I'm no longer am trying to push the tower option. I'm like, I just go hang out in the towers like I did in Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much how it all happened, is that I put in the ERR request for both the tower and the Tracon. And then I got picked up probably 4 months. It was really quick. It's very quick. 4 months after our initial visit. And I had the transfer back to Salt Lake. And then I was here. I was given word in January of It was January, and I reported in March. So it was a really quick when I got my offer letter, and then when I was supposed to report.
Wow. And now you've been to the same facility ever since then?
Yep. I've been here now for, what is it, 12, 13 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. And now, is it, are you, let me see, I'm trying to ask the right question for this one, or maybe, is it your TrayCon, is it the same position or is there different positions within TrayCon?
There's different. So our facility, and it's a, every facility is different as to how they manage the airspace that they're given. So our airspace is broken up. It's stratified. So it's, we have 9 sectors if we open up every position. And that's like if every position is like just firing planes or everywhere, we have 9 sectors to alleviate workload.
Okay.
But Salt Lake is unique in the fact that we work the busy level 12 numbers. So we work the same numbers as like Atlanta and Chicago. But the difference is that after our banks, we lull. So we go into a quiet period. So we have these breaks between banks, whereas the level 12s, these big, the large facilities are constant. It's just all day long. There's really no breaks between the banks. The bank is just like from sun up to sundown.
Damn.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So then now for the, you work at S56. What does the S56 yes. stand for? Is that a, what is that?
It's just an identifier. There's no significance behind it. So every facility, it's just aviation. Everything has an identifier. It's just like SkyWest has its 3-letter identifier. We have a 3-letter identifier. So the TrayCons are always a letter and then 2 numbers.
Okay.
So, and then your centers are usually start with a Z. So Salt Lake Center is ZLC. Like TrayCon is S56. The tower is SLC.
Okay.
And then, so it's like Seattle TrayCon is, I always remember this one because it's pretty close, but it's S46.
S46.
So, yep.
That's
so
cool.
There's just literally just internal identifiers.
Oh, okay. That's cool. And now I visited West Vegas one. Because I've been to the Vegas one, which is right below the tower. Have you ever visited this facility in Vegas?
I have not. I can't remember what it is, what their identifier is.
Oh, no. So I visited that facility once. I got a tour from, I forgot who I reached out to. All I know is we have the same last name. And I think it's Richard. Richard Ramirez is, I think one of the managers, or I forgot his position there, but he worked at the FAA and he offered a tour, and I went and took my dad to take a tour, tour of the facility. And then we went up to the tower. So we looked at the facility, TrayCon facility, and then we went up to the tower. So it was really cool. And something I wanted to point out is that Patrick right now is dressed just like a true controller. You know, their hoodie, they have a hat, and you can see them in front of their desk. You know, they're just in front of the computer. They're just like hoodie and a hat and just looking at a screen. That's exactly what Patrick is dressed right now. He looks like a true controller right now.
It's like the TrayCons get cold, man. Like,
yeah.
That's like what I've learned in radar is because they are literally cooling that equipment because the equipment never gets turned off.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go in there without a hoodie or without a jacket, I am freezing.
Yeah.
So I've inherited over time that like this is just what's become me.
Yeah, because not only that, but it's just that you also bring that up, that the equipment, really we're living in their world, and just the computers, right? So they have to keep the rooms at a certain temperature so that they don't overheat. It's the same thing when I go into a classroom. And some of the devices that we have in there, some rooms are really super cold. You can feel the cold air just coming out of those rooms. So I usually have to bring a jacket when I go and teach in these rooms because they're just freaking cold. Or I bring a little space heater and put it next to me or something just so I can keep myself warm because it's so freaking cold in those rooms because they want to keep the equipment cool and prevent from overheating because the equipment is super finicky. That's what I did. I visited TrayCon once. I've been wanting to visit Denver TrayCon, which I think is offsite, not in Denver. Whereas correct. Here in Vegas, it's in the same building, which is pretty cool. I've never visited Salt Lake because I've never had the opportunity to do so. I'd love to do that.
The invite is there, Manny. Just come on in. We'll take you in.
All right. I'm going to take it up. I'm serious. I think I was looking at my trip. I don't think I have anything in October, but I don't think I've ever done a Salt Lake overnight. It's always just a turn. So I would have to be based out of Salt Lake to do it. But one of these days I'm going to take a special trip, and it's down the street. I'm in Vegas right now. So it's down the street. Yep. Like you said, it's not very far away. So I'm going to make that special trip. And one of these days I'm going to be looking at that, at your facility.
Man. The door is always open. You're always welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So let me get into some more technical questions I wanted to ask you. The first one is, Well, it's more kind of a personal thing to see what you do. But air traffic control is often associated with high levels of stress, right? So I cannot imagine myself doing that because it is so stressful. Like I would lose track of airplanes. I can barely remember what I did like 10 minutes ago. And that, you know, so it's really hard. Now, so how do you manage, how do you personally manage stress in your role as a controller?
Yeah, it's a good question. Honestly, it's like, you don't want to dumbfound or like kind of downplay. That's the word I'm looking for. You don't want to downplay like what the job is that you're doing. But it's like the only thing I can explain it is it's like when you look at the scope, you have two options to as how you look at it. Every single dot, you're going to start calculating bodies, right? How many people are on board those dots?
Okay. Right?
Because then it's like that's where you see a lot of the stress, and we've had people that can't get over that. They know that there's life on the line. And the pressure of these dots getting close or how the procedures work that gets too much for them.
Yeah.
Or it's like you just acknowledge, you just know like this is just the job. I'm working planes that have people, but it's like you're not shutting it out to like downplay safety or anything, but it's just to allow your mind to process the information in front of you.
Yeah.
To keep it moving safely. So for me, it's always been, I look at every plane on my radar and it's just, okay, I know what I've got to sequence. I know my spacing. I know where I'm going to put this aircraft. I know what I've got to do to get it there, speed, vectors, altitude, how I'm going to do it. It might be a straight down descent or it's going to be a sixth altitude step down, you know, depending on how the aircraft are doing their things. But at the end of the day, it's like, I don't walk out of that building without thinking like, I literally just brought, you know, I sent families on vacation. I brought families home from an amazing vacation, you know, family reunions, people that are doing business, you know, everything, you know, every scope across the board. But you kind of walk out of there as like, okay, like I did my job and I did it well. You know, it's like air traffic is one of those things where it's such a team effort based between you and the pilots, but you don't get to go outside afterwards and go high five the pilots that, you know, that you worked with to be like, hey, like,
yeah,
what we did today was incredible. Like awesome. We did this. It wasn't just me. Like,
yeah,
I saw the bigger picture because I'm looking at more, but you guys are flying the planes. You guys are heads up, heads down, adjusting things and doing all of your instrumentation, going through checklists. I'm your eyes when your heads are down, you know, to make sure that like this can work seamlessly. Absolutely. But I can't go out at the end of the day and be like, hey, like everybody, let's high five each other, like, you know, pat each other on the back. Or it's like, hey, like when, you know, like, hey, I asked you to pick up a descent. It might've been an uncomfortable descent, might've been a little bit steeper, or I told you to expedite and you weren't prepared for it, but it's like you did it. And, you know, we're all responding to, you know, each other's, you know, requests. But that commonality that we have on the frequency is probably the best definition of teamwork that I can come up with. But for us, the reality is at the end of the day, I don't get to walk out and be like, hey, like, you know, like a supervisor slaps you on the back, like, hey, that was an awesome job. What you did today was incredible. Yeah. It was like, you're basically left to kind of pick yourself up, right? Like the stress of the job isn't necessarily the stress that people think of it as. Like for me, I never get stressed by it. And I think I was stressed at the start of my career because it was like, I got to get through training. I've got to get, it's a 2 to 3 year training program to get through an en route facility, or it's a year and a half to 2 years for Tracon. And it could be anywhere from 6 months to a year and a half for a tower, depending on the level.
Yeah.
But you can go through it as fast as you need to, and that just determines how hard you are willing to work, how hard are you willing to study. And when you start trying to understand the job and trying to like take all of the rules and the procedures and actually take them from the book, the air traffic Bible, the .65, and you put them on the scope and you see it and you actually get to like see how it works versus just how it's worded.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, that makes sense. This is how it works. And now it's like you're progressing through controlling. You're like, all right, like, it just becomes the job. So the stress of itself in a sense goes away. But some people, like I say, like we've had trainees that have come through that look at a scope and they can't decipher like the problem solving. You know, everybody can work. I always like tell like my wife and like my siblings and like my mom and dad, like I could literally plug them in on a clear blue day. And it's like, for the most part, anybody could almost tell you how to tell a pilot how to descend and get them to the airport safely. But it's where we get the crazy weather that comes in, Mm-hmm. You know, for us in the summer, it's the thunder bumpers that roll through the valley, and that's been all this week. Like, it's been insane, but it's summer or in the winter when the valley just completely goes IFR and there's no visibility. And it's like, you want to talk about teamwork and how pilots rely on controllers to see outside that window for them. That's the time. That's where like the proof in the pudding is, because there's so much reliance upon each other for those things that it's like you actually thrive off the teamwork than it is trying to be like, well, I'm just going to try to prove to people I know what I'm doing. Like,
yeah,
of course we all know what we're doing, but when you know what you're doing as a pilot and I know what I'm doing as a controller and you have those two working together, like literally anything is possible.
Sup, nerds. Before I let you go, I have a task for you. I have a challenge. If you can go to the platform where you're listening to this podcast in and go ahead and leave a review, just tap that star, whether it's a 5-star, I like that very much, or a 4, or a 3, or 2, or a 1. It doesn't matter as long as you leave a review and some criticism so I can improve this podcast, because I want the Tailwinds and Sunshine podcast to be your podcast. So go ahead and leave that review now. I also want to give a huge shout out to my friends and coworkers for sharing the podcast with their friends and family. That means the world to me. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. Also, if you want to be part of the show, go ahead and hit me up. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. We'll make that show happen. We'll make you a friend of the show. Until next time, wishing you tailwinds and sunshine. See ya. The statements made on the show are my own opinion and do not necessarily reflect those of my employer.